This is Red Eyes Creations Radio. My name is Henrik, and I want to thank you for listening to our program and paying attention to the kind of topics that we are focusing on in these interesting times, shall we say, as we break some new ground and discover fascinating things about what is going on this planet. Our website is redicecreations.com. We are growing every day, and I want to thank everyone for your kind emails and the positive feedback we're getting. We read all our email, and we do our best to reply to as much of it as we can. On our website, you can follow along in our frequently updated news, listen to our radio program, watch our webcasts that we just started, by the way, really groundbreaking stuff, and see some of our video interviews, our short films, or listen to some of our extended radio programs that we have available for you on our website. And today we have David Livingstone with us. He is the author of Terrorism and the Illuminati, a 3,000-year history, and also The Dying God, the Hidden History of Western Civilization. And David have two different websites that you can take a look at that are accompanying these books. The website is thedyinggod.com, and the other one you can take a look at is terrorism-illuminati.com. And there's a lot of information up there for you on those websites, so you can further explore some of the areas that David touches upon. And I don't know personally that much about David. I've read a few of his articles, and I think he offers a really interesting perspective, and I want to kind of explore a bit some of his areas here today and talk more about where he's coming from, so to speak. So I'm very grateful to have you on the line here today, David. Thank you very much for coming on.
And thanks for inviting me.
I mean, tell us a little bit about yourself, some of the background. I want to kind of hear a little bit about how you kind of first got involved in some of the in researching some of these areas, David.
I think the easiest way to explain it is that I guess it was about 20 years ago exactly that I was in a university program called Liberal Arts College, and I've since learned that this was an attempt to preach the Hegelian version of history, which is a novel approach and one that's been generally abandoned in education. And so we focused on a history text by The History of Western Civilization by William H. McNeill, who's a professor at the University of Chicago. His mentor was, I can't remember his mentor's name, but his mentor was the one who was responsible for inviting Leo Strauss to the University of Chicago. So this book is, you know, probably the clearest outline of the propaganda version of history that you could come across. And this was the kind of nonsense that they were trying to impose upon me. A funny experience I had too is that at the time, even though I didn't understand, I wasn't educated enough to understand what was happening, what the effort was, but I was challenging my professor, and she said to me, you know, because I said, you know, the problem is I don't always agree with you. She says, well, you know, we want to see that you've learned something. And this is a great lesson, you know, this is obviously that I wasn't allowed to challenge this view. I was there to accept it.
Yes.
And the basic where my research started was this might seem like a remote point, but it's really the underlying issue that helped me discover everything that I've discovered and everything that I reveal in my two books, and really understanding the whole mystery of what we're being subjected to. And there was a reference to the sudden emergence of the Indo-Europeans from the Caucasus Mountains between a period of approximately 2,500 BC. Mm-hmm. So when I read this, it sounded really odd. It didn't make any sense. You know, you look at any other civilization, they emerge slowly over time by people settling down in certain areas like Mesopotamia or Egypt, and they turn to agriculture, which allows them to develop civilizations. Whereas the Indo-Europeans do the opposite, and they begin violently. So they emerge out of the Caucasus, and, you know, which is nonsensical. You know, it's like how, it's like expecting people to just suddenly emerge from the Alps. You know, I mean, where how do people come out of mountains and then supposedly conquer and subjugate the advanced civilizations of the time?
Right.
So it didn't make any sense. It was weird. It sounded mythical. So I just started researching it, and little by little, I eventually discovered what was this notion of these Indo-Europeans was actually a euphemism for the Aryan race. And I eventually discovered that the idea of an Aryan race was a Masonic idea or an occult idea. So then I went on to find out, well, what is this occult religion? How does it have so much impact on history? Mm. And that's when it gets convoluted, because the occult versions of history are very elaborate. So if you read, there's plenty of material as well. I mean, there's lots of books where you can discover the occult versions of history, and they kind of closely mirror mainstream versions of history. But of course, the ideas that are discussed in the occult are never referred to in mainstream versions of history. So how do you study it, right?
Right.
How do you just study the veracity of these claims? You know, when they say that Pythagoras was a godfather of the occult tradition, and he preached so and so, such and such and such and such. How do you check that? And so it becomes very interesting, because you get into this kind of no man's land of history, where of this kind of bridge between mainstream and occult mythology. But it's where the answers are, because the version of history that we're being taught is it's an occult, it's a whitewashed version of occult history. So it's the occult history without actually ever referring to the occult. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
And this is the point, is that this is the modern propaganda. Basically, we can go back to approximately 250 years since this version of history is being imposed, basically since the Enlightenment, but more particularly since Hegel. It's a completely novel way of interpreting history, a complete rewrite of history, but it's been so entrenched that today there's no memory of any other perception of history.
Right.
But what they are trying to teach us is they're trying to teach us history as really their secret plan, but their secret and the progress of their secret plan, and teaching it to us as if it's just the natural and spontaneous intellectual evolution of humanity.
Right. So,
I
just want to ask you, so, I mean, when you were taking this this course, this class you were talking about, did you just feel that something was wrong in the way that they you know, explained history in that regard, or did you at that point already had some kind of alternate version that you kind of, you relied on to get your information, so to speak?
No, I didn't have an alternate version yet. I just had a sneaking, wasn't even a sneaking suspicion. It was just a, you know, very basic intuition.
Right.
Bogus, or fishy at least. So, I started to dig, and it's only, in fact, it's only recently that I've discovered, and now I'm very suspicious about this place, because no, really, I mean, they deliberately used the Owl of Minerva as the mascot of this place. And if anybody wants to look it up, it's the Liberal Arts College of Concordia University. The Owl of Minerva, of course, is a very important symbol, and a very important occult symbol. And it was obliquely referred to by Hegel. And that's the reason why they use the mascot by that school, because it was referred to by Hegel. And it has a long history, the owl symbolism, but that made it very, very fishy indeed.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, the point I wanted to make is that is that when the Illuminati was originally founded, one of the first grades of the Illuminati were was the Minerval grades, or the grades of Minerva, which were considered for, I believe they were set up for young people to kind of begin their entry into Illuminati indoctrination. So interesting that they would use that, you know, to basically create a Minerval college.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, I want to also kind of back out a little bit and again talk about this big perspective and if you will, kind of paint a picture for us. You've begun doing so already, obviously, but more of just of who is in control of the world today. I mean, we can approach this from different areas. We can talk about some of the different groups that you've been primarily studying or some of the different agendas that are out there. But where do you think is a good place to begin? Let's say you're talking to a novice in this subject, so to speak. I mean, for instance, you put the title of Illuminati on your book, of course. And if we begin there, or specifically referring to like the Order of Perfect Abilists that Weishaupt set up in Bavaria, or are using this term, as many researchers do now, as a broad term to kind of explain a larger group or an agenda?
Yeah. I use it as a broad term because, like as I said, as I started to discover this occult version of history, I sought out to find out its origin. And I wanted to be very accurate in what I discovered. I wanted to discover it for, you know, its definite origins. And what of course everybody knows that the occult is based on Kabbalah. And but Kabbalists claim that it originates originally from Babylon, or they say it originates from Moses or the fallen angels before the flood, so on and so forth. So those are various claims about the antiquity of the Kabbalah. Mm-hmm. But what I've determined is that it emerged in the 6th century BC. So when I say Illuminati, I'm talking about a secret occult doctrine which has been preserved and pushed forward, or which accompanies an agenda that's been pushed forward since the 6th century BC. So, of course, the Illuminati was created in the 18th century, so it has to be used in a broader sense to refer to this group or secret organization, which has been around for a very long time.
Yes. The Kabbalists, let's begin there. What do you think, where do you think that this, you know, originates from? You're mentioning Babylon and way back. Are we talking about the Hebrews or a Zionist faction here? What do you think, David?
Yeah. And the interesting thing is, yeah, what happens is in the 6th century BC, when the Jews were taken into Babylon, basically, there's argument about how many, but supposedly nearly the entire population, or at least the best and the brightest of the population, were taken to Babylon in captivity. And what happened is that this was a huge catastrophe for the Jewish people, because they had already been placed in the Promised Land according to their own scriptures. So their settlement in the Promised Land was understood as a binding agreement between themselves and God. So when they became severed from the land of Zion, essentially, it forced them to reinterpret the meaning of their relationship with God. It was supposed to have been understood as a punishment because of their paganism through the years. But instead, it seems that a number of them chose to not see it as a punishment, but only as a temporary, sort of a temporary upheaval. And what they did is they rationalized their paganism. To make a long story short, essentially, it was a bastardization of the Jewish doctrine, and incorporated elements of Babylonian magic and astrology. And that's pretty much what the Kabbalah is.
And do you think that that's you know, I don't know what kind of connotation you put on that, but do you think that that's in some way shall we say, evil? Does that imply that they're in cahoots with the Dark Lords, as it were? What's your take on that?
Absolutely. This is where you get into the issue of the dying god. Because throughout the ancient Middle East, ancient peoples used to worship this deity called many, many different names. So the Egyptians worshipped them as Osiris, the Greeks as Dionysus or Apollo, the Babylonians as Bel or Marduk, and the Canaanites as Baal. So this was a god who was believed to, first of all, I should say that, he was a god who was identified with the sun. He was also one of a trinity. So the father was the first god, and the father had a daughter, and the father mates with the daughter and produces a son. Then the son marries this goddess. So the son is at the same time the son of the goddess, as well as the as his spouse.
Right.
So these two gods essentially are viewed as one, and they're equated to. She's Venus and he's the sun, but they're basically interchangeable as a kind of a dual aspects of a single androgynous god. So because this god is identified with the sun, he's believed to die every year during winter when the days get shorter, because it's nature worship. So it's tied to fertility. It's a fertility cult in a sense. So it's believed that this god is tied to the fertility of the land. So the crops die in the winter, they revive in the spring. And it's effectively tied to a mating between the god and the goddess, which produces the offspring or the return of the fertility of the land. Mm-hmm. And so when the god dies, he's believed to go to the underworld. And in the underworld, he is the ruler of the souls of the dead. Now, what this means is not really, this is not souls of the dead, but this is the mistaken identity of what are really disembodied spirits, or what we call today ghosts or ghouls or whatever. Mm. So, essentially, he is the ruler of demons or spirits or whatever you want to call them. But these, in ancient times, these disembodied spirits were believed to be the souls of departed beings, departed humans, just as much as today's ghosts continue to be believed as being souls of dead people caught in some kind of a, you know, intermediate stage of existence.
Right.
So essentially he becomes identified with evil. The Greeks called it Pluto, and the underworld was called Hades. This is just their equivalent of the same belief that was held throughout the ancient Middle East. And so in ancient times, it was believed that good and evil were it's a dualistic belief. So evil was not considered to be a breach of good, but an equal and opposite force to good. So if the good god requires rites of worship and rituals and sacrifices, then the evil god also requires rites and rituals and sacrifices to appease him, because he's a god as well. So while the good god requires good sacrifices, the evil god requires evil sacrifices. And the worst sacrifice you could make, the most evil sacrifice you could make, is the slaughter of a human child. So this becomes the basis of this ancient cult of the dying god, and you'll find this all over the place. All over the Middle East, it's consistent. And this is why, if you, in reading the Bible, you'll find that when the Jews, the first thing they do is when they leave Egypt, they're supposed to worship God as a truly transcendent being, and to reject the paganism that they had witnessed or been introduced to. But as soon as they cross the Red Sea, the first thing they do is, while Moses is on Mount Sinai receiving the tablets of the Ten Commandments, they build a golden calf.
Right.
Now, this golden calf is recognized by scholars as being the Apis bull of the Egyptians, which is basically an incarnation of Osiris. So, in other words, a dying god who's consistently identified with some kind of horned creature, usually a goat or a bull, in that time period. And so that's the first instance of their worship of this type of god. Then they're punished for this. They go into they eventually make their way to Palestine, and there, when after they conquer that land, they're told repeatedly in the Bible, first of all, not to intermarry with those people, but most importantly, not to adopt the religious practices of the Canaanite people,
mm-hmm.
who worship the same dying god and goddess, but under the names of Baal and Astarte, or Ishtar as she was known to the Babylonians, or Athena as she's known to the Greeks.
Mm.
So they're told not to, but despite that, they do. And this paganism becomes so entrenched in that early Jewish civilization that the temple itself becomes a place of worship for these two pagan gods. That it's, you know, I would believe that if you were able to transplant yourself to ancient Israel, that you would not find Judaism, except maybe under, you know, a very, very small minority of strict adherents or reformers.
Mm-hmm.
But the population itself basically had adopted a pagan cult that made them indistinguishable from the rest of the pagan peoples of that time, which is why they were known as Phoenicians and described as having as practiced circumcision, but the ancient world made no distinction as to their religious practices.
Hmm.
And so most importantly, the Jews are sacrificing their children to Moloch. And Moloch, again, is just a derivation of the dying god, just another name for Saturn. In fact, more specifically, Moloch is, as I said, Saturn already, because I'm I'm thinking ahead of myself. What I meant is a incarnation of Baal. He is Saturn, because Saturn is understood esoterically as being the opposite of the sun. Saturn is the nocturnal sun. So Saturn is a dark aspect of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So black magic rituals are dedicated to Saturn. So throughout the Bible, this is the complaint that God has against the Jewish people, is that they're practicing astrology, they're witchcraft, things like divination, channeling, spirit channeling, and worst of all, human sacrifice. And of course, you know, to go back, actually, we should go back to what these rituals really involved. Is this is what the worship of the golden calf involved was what the Bible refers to as pagan revelry. And what this means essentially is an orgy, which is still to this day what these rituals are about, as the movie Eyes Wide Shut was trying to let you in on.
Right.
Well, because throughout the ancient Middle East, you'll find that this is how the worship consistently took place, is that first there was some kind of intoxicant that was taken. I guess it depended on which part of the world you lived in. So the Greeks had wine, and I guess probably the Egyptians had beer. Different, or, you know, maybe some other kind of intoxicant. And the intoxicant was to kind of help the worshiper lose their morals, in a sense, to make a simple point, because that's essentially what it was. And then it was accompanied by music, and the music helped then this intoxicated devotee to become excited, in a sense, or what the Greeks called enthusiasmos, or being in the god. Essentially, it riled them to a heightened state of whatever you call it, and essentially where they believed, I guess, they would become possessed by the god. And this kind of irrational exuberance. I didn't mean to make that connection. Anyway, so they, in this state, then they were able to do things like kill a child and rip it apart and eat its flesh, or cook it and then eat it, which is what took place. And of course, the music was not only there to excite the worshippers, but also to drown out the cries of the dying child. And these rituals were usually followed by orgies. Most importantly, the sacred marriage, which was a ritual sex between a priest and a priestess who impersonated the god and the goddess. And out of this mating was supposed to produce a son of God, who was basically a living incarnation of the dying god. Hmm. Understand that, then you understand the entire basis of the occult belief system. And this idea explains everything, if we have time to go through it, explains the basis of everything, of the entire process of Western, so-called Western history.
Hmm. But very interesting. I want to see if we can tie this together in some way to this idea of the bloodlines. I think you mentioned previously about the Luciferian.
Right.
Yeah, the Luciferian bloodlines and the royal bloodlines. We can go into that, of course, as well. But would you say that this was something then that was... I personally have always tried to figure out where, you know, what the origins of the royal bloodlines is. You know, where did they actually come from day one, and what separated them from the other people in that particular region? Have you been able to track this back in any way, and where do you think that this leads to?
Yes, I have. In fact, I thought I had covered every question that I could have in my first book, and I was truly shocked to discover the amount of information that I discovered from my second book.
And that's The Things Dying God, correct?
My second book is The Terrorism Union.
Okay.
The Illuminati.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
And things that I have never seen referred to anywhere, even in occult books, but I was able to discover only by following the bloodlines. And following the bloodlines would usually identify certain important characters through history, because they always become a focus of intermarriage or a reconnecting of lost veins in this bloodline, and it helped me to identify certain people through history. And then so when I would see this name recur all the time, I'd say a person that I had never heard of before, and never even ever mentioned before by anyone or any book or history book, and I would look it up and find out that yes, they had a very pivotal role, usually in the occult, in mainstream history as well, but usually with some very important occult connection, and it often helped explain some of the things that were going on. Mm. But to get back to the point is that the dying god, as I said, was known as Venus. The original Latin name for Venus is Lucifer.
Yes.
So I guess you probably understood my point, is that the worship of the dying god going all the way back was the worship of darkness, or the worship of Lucifer. What happens that when in Babylon, instead of recognizing that this exile is a punishment, this captivity is a punishment for their paganism, for the 800 years before that, they instead rationalize it, and then they create the Kabbalah as a disguise, as an attempt to amalgamate or to disguise their pagan worship with Jewish themes, so that this worship of the dying god, Lucifer, is hidden in what's called an interpretation, and that interpretation is known as Kabbalah. So from there, from that point in the 6th century BC, is where you have the beginnings of this formalized worship of Lucifer, in a sense.
Hmm. I've seen that, you know, Lucifer, obviously, you know, translated means light. I've always think that this is about the worship of light. And again, even Venus as that kind of, you know, a rebel planet, basically breaking away, as it were.
Absolutely.
And also the idea then that's why they call themselves the Illuminati, the Illuminated Ones, and the idea of the Enlightenment. And would you say that all these things are connected then in that way?
Well, you know, yeah, absolutely. Very much. The idea is the Kabbalah is the source of Gnosticism. So Gnosticism is a reversal of the Bible. So Gnosticism interprets the Bible in reverse. So the God, the creator of the universe, is then considered evil, and the devil is considered good. So the good God imposed a number of moral restrictions on us, whereas the evil God showed us the supposed light, quote-unquote, light. And that light is liberty. So the devil taught us freedom. He taught us freedom from God. He taught us freedom from morals. And in as simple as that sounds, that's as simple as it is. That's what they believe. They believe that moral restrictions are just conventions invented by human beings and are completely unnecessary, because they believe that life, so they reject God, so they believe that life is survival of the fittest.
David, what do you think? Because one thing that puzzles me here is the idea that if freedom is the thing that is kind of, venerated, so to speak, then it becomes difficult to understand why ritualistic behavior, for instance, like if we talk about child sacrifice or what have you, that seems to be a very binding and obligating thing and seems to be kind of contradictory to the idea of freedom and to do whatever it is that you want to do. Is that an...
Yeah, but
can you figure that out in a way? It's very difficult to understand the logic behind it in a way. What do you think?
Because you have to understand that human sacrifice, the sacrifice of a human's child is the most evil act you can make, right? So that's the point. It's a process of emancipation in their eyes, because if you accept then, first of all, that God is evil, or that there is no God, which is basically the same concept, and that therefore there are no morals, there is no such thing as right and wrong. All that matters is Nietzsche's will to power. All that matters is the advancement of yourself above others. And you are entitled to do whatever it is that you want to or can to achieve the advancement of your own power. Not only that, but you should seek out to do what is otherwise considered evil as a way of demonstrating or actualizing this belief. And that's the point. So, many Gnostics...
So that should help you to kind of break you free from the moral structures and things like that?
It's demonstrating your freedom from morals, from God.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's showing your ability to do what others would consider evil. It's demonstrating your ability to refute. The most important... The best... There's a movie which was deliberately... marketed to explain this point, and that's Apocalypse Now.
Oh, really? Tell us more about it.
Yeah. Because it took me a long time to understand exactly what that movie was trying to say. But if you listen very carefully, Colonel Kurtz basically is supposedly evil. He's evil in the minds of the rest of the world. But the Martin Sheen character discovers that there's a little bit more to it than that. That yes, he's gone too far, but he's discovered something. And what he says is that when he was leading his troops or whatever his platoon into they inoculated children in a Vietnamese village. They went away, and when they came back, the Viet Cong had chopped off the arms of all these children, and they were there in a pile. And he said that in that moment he wasn't horrified, but it hit him like a diamond bullet piercing his skull. And what did he realize? He realized, he said, the genius in that. And what he meant is that he realized the ability to not be constrained by the limitations of what people believe is moral, but recognizing what will accomplish your ends, and being able to do whatever it is, to do acts which are considered otherwise horribly evil, but to recognize that they're necessary to do, and having what they understand as the moral strength to be able to do that. That's the whole point.
And that really also tells you something about the human mentality then, because in a way, really to be truly free in that sense, you would actually have to do nothing. But again, if you have to resort to acts of extreme violence in order to feel freedom, if you will, that really tells you how perverted the mindset and the morals of that particular person is, obviously. But, you know.
Absolutely.
Yes.
You know, see, the thing is that movie culture has caricaturized the idea of evil to the point where people, a lot of people don't even believe there's such a thing as evil because it's so ridiculed. But that's not what really, that's what evil is.
It's in the human.
It's a rejection
being.
Of good. Absolutely. And so, you know, that explains 9/11. Right?
Give me a bit more on that. Kissinger
is a fan of Machiavelli. So is, what's his name? The supposed leader of the neoconservative movement.
Leo Strauss?
No, not him. The current one. What's his name? Who wrote his PhD dissertation was on Machiavelli. And he's trying to revive that. Mm. He's trying to revive Machiavelli and set the end of my book. For some ways, like my mind. And, so that's the point, right? It's the ends justify the means.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if it means having to sacrifice several thousand of your own citizens, but if it provides you with a pretext to advance this supposedly good cause,
right.
Then it must be done. They pride themselves in their ability to do these acts of evil because they think that it proves their strength.
And as far as I've been able to figure out as well, because you mentioned Hegel a little bit in the beginning here, and it's that idea that they've observed, you know, a little bit of what actually goes on in nature. Because again, we do have these cycles in nature. We have life and death. We have these opposites that actually are, in the true sense, as I see it right now, that they are creating life on this planet, if you will. I mean, we must have winter in order to have summer. We must have actually death to have life in a way. But what I've seen is that they've adopted this philosophy and applied it to human civilization in that regard, or, you know, to their civilization, that they think that they need to do A and B in order to get C, their desired results. Would you say that that's a correct assertion?
It's an interesting point. It's never occurred to me before. I'd have to think about it.
Okay, right.
It's an interesting concept, yeah.
Right.
But, you know, the good is such a simple idea. You know, it's so easy. We've been indoctrinated in this idea that we've had several philosophers who have attempted to achieve the truth, and that it's supposedly convoluted and requires, you know, tomes of convoluted, you know, terminologies and logic, but it doesn't. In fact, most of those philosophers were occult theologians. The truth is very, 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 very simple. It's just to believe in equality, to believe, to do unto others. Then that's it. It's not much more complicated than that.
Right. I want to return a little bit again
belief is the opposite.
Okay, gotcha, right. I want to return a little bit, David, to the idea of the bloodlines again, the royal bloodlines, and tie it back and just ask you again there, if you've been able to find like the origins of the royal bloodlines, and if so, what group of people were they, do you think?
Okay. Well, what I've been able to find is, first I'll tell you the belief, and then I'll tell you the actuality, or what I've been able to identify as real.
Okay.
The belief is that they are descended from the fallen angels. So they believe, if you read the Bible, it says that the sons of God descended to earth and interbred with human beings to produce the Anakim, who were giants. But if you read the apocryphal works like the Book of Enoch, it explains that these sons of God were actually fallen angels. So Lucifer and his followers, and that they, when they descended to earth, they interbred with the female descendants of Cain, and to them they taught magic. So supposedly the origin of the Kabbalah is from the fallen angels who taught it to the human descendants of Cain prior to the flood.
Hmm.
And according to the book, anyway, I don't want to complicate the story, but essentially these Anakim, some of them survived the flood. So when the Jews are commanded to conquer the land of Canaan, what happens there is they get frightened because they see the sons of Anak are there, who are giants, as Goliath was a giant. So this is a reference to the idea that the Canaanites essentially represent descendants of the Anakim, or the human half-breeds, the supposedly divine half-breeds of fallen angels and humans.
Yes.
So this is very important because, first of all, it's from the Canaanites that the Jews adopt the worship of the dying god. And these are called practices of human sacrifice and orgiastic rituals and so on and so forth. And the Bible states very clearly that every time it says that it warns the Jews not to, I'm not supposed to say Jews because at this time there is no Jews, they are Israelites. But anyway, some people like to make that minor point. I don't think it's much of an issue, but I have to say it.
Right.
Just so I don't appear like I'm misinformed. But so every time the Bible says don't worship the gods of the Canaanites, it also says don't intermarry with them. And yet, every single major, almost every single major person in the Bible is of Canaanite blood or marries a Canaanite. Hmm. Most of the kings, like David and Solomon and was it Judah and Tamar, I guess? So, anyway, that's where I get fuzzy. But you'll find that throughout, so basically, the line of Davidic kings in the Bible, from whom the Messiah is supposed to come from, have been intermarried with Canaanites. So in a sense, because the point of Kabbalah is to bring about the rule of the Messiah, who is a descendant of the Son of God. So under the understanding of the Kabbalah, the Messiah is a descendant of David, but also of the fallen angels and Lucifer through the Canaanites.
So are you saying that like Christ and the Antichrist is from the same line then, or what are you saying here?
What I'm saying is what they think.
Oh, yeah, I got that, but do you think that that their ideology then is that Antichrist or, you know, the and Christ will come from the same line, from the same bloodline?
They don't believe in Christ. They believe the Messiah is still to come, who, in a sense, is the Antichrist. And this is why the intermarriage has to be so carefully monitored, because it has to preserve this so-called divine blood, which is basically Luciferian blood.
Right.
And they have to do this because they have to preserve this purity throughout history to produce, eventually, the Messiah.
Right.
And this is where you get dynasties and royalty and nonsense like that.
And the obsession by keeping that line, so to speak, and keeping track of the genealogy, and don't bring any other genes, if you will, or blood then into that particular line, correct?
Exactly. It has to be pure Aryan blood, which is understood to be divine Luciferian blood.
And, okay, so what you've explained there is what they believe. What do you believe then about this?
Oh gosh, where do you want me to start? I mean, it's the Antichrist.
Do you think that there is some element of truth in this, or is that total bunk? You know, do they make this up in order to prop themselves up to create a story here? Or what do you think?
Well, you know, my personal conviction is I'm a Muslim, so I believe it's likely true. There's a verse in the Quran that implies that the devil was permitted to interbreed with human beings. And this is a notion that's been around for years, that disembodied spirits can produce offspring with human beings. In the Middle Ages, they were called succubi or incubi.
Right.
And you know, Rosemary's Baby is very much that idea as well, right? They hold a ritual, and the devil comes and impregnates a woman to produce the Antichrist.
Right.
But in in a cult ritual, this takes place. This is called a sacred marriage. In fact, this is a very important, this is the central point of the Da Vinci Code. And he says what he calls a hieros gamos, because it's he accurately calls it that because it's an ancient occult ritual of sacred marriage. And the story is important because the woman Sophie, which is another important occult
name.
Yes. She stumbles on her grandfather in the midst of an occult sexual rite of sacred marriage, which we are to understand by from Dan Brown is that supposed to be the true Christianity, which is utter nonsense. And but that sacred ritual is to produce, just to continue the bloodline, right? And it's the priest and priestess impersonate the god and goddess. What's supposed to happen is that the priest is supposed to, in that ritual, is supposedly possessed by the god. So the child is actually the child of Lucifer. And this is how they continue the bloodline, so that these kings and queens are just living embodiments of the purest incarnations of this bloodline.
So, I mean, we can work ourselves up here a little bit, so to speak, into the, you know, more modern era, what is going on now. And I want to ask you a little bit about the Rothschilds and what is known as the Grail bloodline. We have about 5 minutes left in the segment before we can take a break and continue, but we can begin maybe to talk a little bit about the Rothschilds and what I guess you would refer to as the Grail bloodline. Does that carry on from that tradition that you just talked about in regards to the Dan Brown kind of mythology that they're building up right now? What do you think?
Absolutely. It's the Holy Grail is the mythology of this bloodline. And it helps to explain the whole basis of it. And what I discovered is that while they claim to come from, you know, they claim to come from Nimrod, from the fallen angels, Egyptian kings, and so on and so forth, what I did find is that the bloodlines focus back, they can all be traced back to Herod the Great. And that's the real key.
Okay.
Do you know who Herod the Great was?
Yeah, give us a little bit of background on him, if you will, for our listeners.
Well, basically, he was part of a family who were Edomites, and the Edomites were they were actually descended not from they weren't really Jewish. They were descendants of Esau, who were so it was the Jews were descended from Isaac, whereas the Edomites were descended from Isaac's brother, Esau, who took the name Edom because he was red. And so King Herod was a member of a family of Edomites who had converted to Judaism. So there was a bit of resentment against their rule because they weren't considered real Jews. But King Herod was the one, when the Magi came to him and told him that they had witnessed the birth of the Messiah, he orders the slaughter of the innocents, which is basically a euphemism for child sacrifice again, except this time on a mass scale. And he orders the slaughter of all the firstborn sons, but Mary and Joseph escape to Egypt, and Jesus eventually survives. And that's a very important point. So he's the evil king of the Bible who tries to eliminate Jesus.
Right. So the Rothschilds, do you think, basically ties back to King Herod then? Is that what you're saying here?
Well, just considered Red Shield.
Yes.
I'm being vague right now because we'd only have a few minutes left, but there's a lot to talk about.
I understand, yes. Well, why don't we take a break at this point then? We can continue talking more in our member section. But I do want to give out some of your details, of course. I want you to mention both of your websites again, and I also want to give you an opportunity to mention where people can go if they want to pick up copies of your either one or both of your books. Where would they go to do that?
My first book, The Dying God, The Hidden History of Western Civilization, is at thedyinggod.com. And my more recent book, Terrorism and the Illuminati, is at www.terrorism-illuminati.com. There's also a PDF version of my book available for free on the site. And the entire book can be read on the site as well.
Very good. So there's a lot of information up there, and do check it out in case you want a physical version of that, of course. And you have links to where people can get the book?
Yes, I do. Yeah, you can buy it at Amazon as well. Yeah.
Very good. Okay, well, thank you very much for this segment here, David. Stay with us. We'll take a short break and we'll continue in a little while.
Thank you very much.
It's criminal. There ought to be a law. A criminal. It ought to be a whole lot more. You get nothing for nothing. Baby, who can you trust? I got what you want. And baby, you got the lust. If you want blood, baby, you got it. If you want blood, you got it. Blood in the streets, blood on the rocks, blood in the gutter, every last drop. You want blood. This animal living in a human zoo. Animal, all the shit they toss to you. Feeling like a prisoner, locked in a cage, thrown to lions on a second phase. If you want blood, baby, you got it. If you want blood, you got it. Blood in the sheets, blood in the sky, blood in the gutter, every last drop. You want blood.